This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Bridge Across the Stars, a sci-fi bridge original anthology by Rhett C. Bruno, Felix R. Savage, Daniel Aronson, David Van Dyke, Will McIntosh, Craig Martell, Patty Jansen, Lindsay Baroker, Jason Anspach, Anne Christie, Chris Dietzel, Josie Russell, Chris Porto, Steve Bollier, Lucas Bale, Maya Catherine Bonhoff, and David Bruns. Edited by Chris Porto and Rhett C. Bruno. Forward by Kevin J. Anderson. Narrated by Greg Tremblay and Nicole Poole. Forward to the collection by Kevin J. Anderson. When I was a kid, the universe opened up for me with thought-provoking and imaginative space adventures about colonies on other planets, alien intelligences, time travel, and mind-bending scientific inventions. My real world was nowhere near as exciting. In fact, it was quite mundane, and I think I was the only dreamer for miles around. As a boy, I lived in a speck-on-the-map small town in southeastern Wisconsin, not the sort of place that would inspire big thinking and lots of creativity. Sure, it was a charming, laid-back environment straight out of a Norman Rockwell painting with red barns and cornfields, where nobody locked their doors and where all of the neighbors were related to me somehow. Franksville, Wisconsin was a place with absolutely no imagination and no excitement. Anyone who longed for adventure beyond the stars had to travel vicariously. And that's where the library came in, with its science fiction section, which comprised the top half of one tall set of metal bookshelves. At the time, reading four entire shelves of books, each book sporting a little rocket ship logo surrounded by an atom symbol, seemed a daunting task. Like the characters I watched on Star Trek, which my young imagination didn't think was nearly as good as Lost in Space because it had more monsters, I decided to embark on a 5-year mission to boldly go where no man has gone before. Or at least where no kid in my town had gone before. I wanted to read all the science fiction, every book in the world. And surely my library had them all on that one set of shelves. Paul Anderson, Isaac Asimov, Ray Bradbury, Arthur C. Clarke. Yes, I started at the beginning of the alphabet. But even that was too slow a delivery system. I needed more science fiction and faster. I discovered that the way to get the most science fiction ideas delivered like a triple espresso was to read big SF anthologies. My small town library had every volume of Nebula Award winners and an entire set of the Orbit anthology series, edited by Damon Knight. But a lot of those stories were too artsy and esoteric for my 12-year-old tastes. I didn't know anything about the New Wave movement or experimental writing. I just wanted great stories. I was in the age of wonder. Then I discovered the story collections of Ray Bradbury and Isaac Asimov. Asimov would take an idea and run with it. Bradbury blew my mind in collection after collection. The Golden Apples of the Sun, The Illustrated Man, R is for Rocket, S is for Space, The Martian Chronicles. Best of all, I discovered several giant SF anthologies edited by Groff Conklin. A treasury of science fiction, the big book of science fiction, great short novels of science fiction. These were massive tomes, chock full of adventures taken from the pages of the best pulp magazines. Amazing stories, astounding science fiction, thrilling wonder stories. The true breeding ground of the genre. During the summer, when I was reading those anthologies, I might have slept in small-town Wisconsin, but my mind really lived in the wildest frontiers of space and time. That's when I really fell in love with short stories. And it wouldn't do to just read them. I decided to start writing stories of my own and sending them to magazines. I began to get those published, nearly 150 of them so far. Even though some of the magazines are still around, today's true breeding ground for the best short SF stories is in anthologies. And the most fertile land for new anthologies comes out of the indie presses. Some anthologies are assembled along traditional lines, such as those from my own Wordfire Press, but others are more of a co-op venture with ambitious indie writers and publishers throwing a party with their imagination. Bridge Across the Stars is one such book. Here, you'll find a wide selection of big SF stories, big ideas, and big adventures, written by well-established veterans such as Maya K. Bonhoff and Will McIntosh, to extremely successful indie authors such as Lindsay Baroker, David Van Dyke, Jason Anspach, Daniel Aronson, and Patty Jansen. You'll read great tales by emerging talents like Retzi Bruno, Craig Martell, Chris Porteau, Anne Christie, Chris Dietzel, David Bruns, Steve Bollier, Josie Russell, Lucas Bale, and Felix R. Savage. Turn your imaginations loose. To find these great stories, you don't have to do your searching like I did. You have the stories right here. But wouldn't it be cool if someone actually discovered this collection on a shelf in the science fiction section of a tiny small-town library? Oh, one other thing about all those big anthologies that I read as a kid. I remember many of them had forewords where the editor talked about the stories themselves and his process in choosing them. I never read the forewords. I just dove right into the stories. So, what are you listening to this for? Get started on the real fiction. As the Sparks Fly Upward by David Van Dyke. Yet mankind is born unto trouble as the sparks fly upward. Job, chapter 5, verse 7. First Lieutenant Joseph Bull Ben Torres, Earth Fleet Marines, jerked upright in his bunk as the assault carrier Melita's general quarters alarm shrieked. In droll counterpoint, its recorded voice calmly called all hands to battle stations. Adrenaline warred with sleep as Bull rolled to his feet and pulled on his combat underlayers with well-drilled motions. The smart cloth resisted shrapnel, spread heat, wicked sweat, compressed injuries, and more, all in service to the battle suits that kept every Fleet Marine alive. As he dressed, Bull waited for more details to come over the PA. Were they under sudden attack by Meme Empire ships? Was the carrier reacting to flash orders that would send her boosting for a rendezvous in battle? Or was it a no-notice drill? It didn't matter. His actions were the same. At least, they were until the lights went out. A shock took his feet out from under him, and he found himself falling gently to the floor, a sure sign the grav plating had defaulted to emergency backup, and a sure sign of severe damage to the ship. Accessing his cybernetic chipset, Bull extended his optical implant's range up and down until the combination of UV and infrared gave him limited sight. He completed donning his equipment, keying his internal comlink as he did, hoping someone was up. "I'm here, Bull," he heard his company first sergeant, Jill Reaper Repath, reply. "But I can't reach the bridge. Oxcon says the task force got jumped and the other ships have their hands full, so we're on our own."
"On my way to the armory," Bull said.
He'd feel a lot better in a battle suit.
"Meet you there."
In the passageway's dim emergency lighting gave plenty of illumination to his implanted eye. He smelled the telltale tang of combustion mixed with fire suppression chemicals. Swabbies in damage control gear hurried past, using handholds or magnetic boots to assist their movements. Bull did the same and had almost reached the armory when his field of view shredded. Instinctively lifting his arms and squeezing his eyes shut, he felt a roaring wall of debris fling him backward, and he took a blow to the head. A long moment later, he shook free of a half-ton of wreckage that would have pinned him if the grav plating had been operating at full. As it was, a strong, steady push left him standing free in a section of passageway, bruised and foggy-headed, but otherwise uninjured.
"Reaper?"
No answer. He ran through channels.
"Any station? Anyone?"
Nothing. Damn it. Maybe it's my comms, or maybe there's nobody to reach. A quick examination showed the corridor ahead to be hopeless. Something had punched deep into the ship, probably a hypervelocity penetrator or hyper. The non-explosive living bullets were favorites of the alien meme and their slave races. Cheap, semi-smart, easy to gestate from local materials. Bull tried to access the shipnet, but got no connection. He turned away and tried to find a route around to the armory. All the Marines' equipment was stored near the hull for maximum accessibility and proximity to the assault sleds, but not for easy damage control. Vital ship's systems occupied the prime real estate near the center of the wheel-shaped vessel. And that protection didn't seem to have saved the ship. He could only hope the Earth Fleet crew had control, and that the task force's combat vessels, missile frigates, destroyers, beam cruisers, and the fearsome wedge-shaped armored battleship Tokyo would be in better shape and come to Melita's rescue. Bull's inner ear alerted him to a drop in pressure, and he grabbed a breathing rig from an emergency cabinet and pulled it on. The lightweight, clear nanoplastic helmet mated to his skin suit, creating a short-term spacesuit, while its two small air tanks on a back harness gave him a couple of hours of oxygen. A tinny sound rattled through the passageway, and it took him a moment to realize he was hearing weapons fire, and the cries of the injured, muffled by the low pressure. Adrenaline flooded his system, and he instinctively enabled a full cybernetic combat mode. Combat? What the hell were people doing shooting? And Bull without a weapon. Or at least a firearm. By the usual definitions, he was a weapon, if he could get close enough. Swarming forward through the detritus of damage, he scanned for movement. As he rounded a corner, he saw a suited crewman backing up and intermittently discharging his fire extinguisher, creating a cloud of condensation. The cloud fractured and split, showing lines of weapons fire reaching for the crewman. In response, the man clicked the tank to continuous blast and chucked it in the direction of his attacker, and then turned to run, or swim, away. He lifted his hands, startled upon encountering Bull.
"Who's shooting?"
Bull barked, grabbing the man. His suit name tag read Calvin.
"Spacer Calvin, report!"
Sir, it's one of us. She just started shooting."
Calvin struggled to get past Bull.
"It must be a meme infiltrator."
Bull shook the man.
"Focus, Spacer, I need to get to the armory. Where's the nearest maintenance crawlway?"
Calvin pointed upward and back the way Bull had come.
"There."
Bull hustled around the corner, dragging the crewman with him as projectiles spanged off the crystal bulkheads. He spotted the hatch in the overhead, one of many maintenance access panels he normally paid no attention to.
"Hell," he said. "I can't get through there."
At more than 2 meters tall and 150 kilos, Bull was the biggest man on the ship. A ship not designed for people his size.
"You go. Try to reach the armory, get weapons and ammo, and then come find me or any other Marines."
The man nodded and undogged the panel. In a moment, he'd vanished into the guts of the damaged ship, closing the hatch. Bull wondered whether the frightened man would do his job or simply hide. No matter. Bull crouched at the corner, readying himself. His enhanced hearing detected unhurried footsteps advancing toward him. When the sound reached 1 meter's range, Bull surged upward and around the corner, reaching for the firearm he expected the infiltrator to hold. His textbook attack found a pulse rifle, exactly where he anticipated. His right hand closed on it, wrenching it away, while his left hand blurred, its edge slamming into the wielder's neck just below the jaw. It takes a lot to break a human neck, and Bull had put more speed than power into the blow, so the target merely slumped, slowly, toward the deck. Bull had already thought of several reasons not to kill, beginning with his need for information, and ending in the possibility that she was just an ordinary woman, influenced by meme biotech. Mind control, in other words, and it might be reversible. Bull shuddered with the same visceral horror most humans felt when contemplating the amoeba-like meme, their blends and their slave races. Better to die than be brainwashed and lose what made him human. Fortunately, if given time, such a reprogrammed person could be cleansed of alien influence. So, Bull snagged the unconscious shooter and pulled her through the nearest door into a cramped enlisted quarters. When he placed her on a bunk, he saw a fresh-faced, sweet young thing looking barely out of her teens. Then again, with the Eden plague, everyone tended to look young. 8 beds lined the small room, folded out from the side walls with a narrow passage between. No crew were present, they'd all be at their stations. Bull had just strapped his prisoner tightly into the bunk using the acceleration webbing when another crash rippled through the ship structure. Bull felt the shock in his bones. While he'd never experienced a ship die around him, in that moment he thought Melita might have taken a mortal wound, and he still couldn't reach anyone on his comm implant. Yet the assault carrier was in open space, The crew would fight to save her, as would her sister ships. Right now, Bull had a different problem. Klaxons rang again for a moment, and then died, leaving only an eerie silence. After a moment, Bull detected a faint hissing, and then a scraping creak as the compartment sealed itself. His inner ear adjusted, this time to slightly increased pressure. The telltale on the rig he wore showed just over one-half standard atmosphere, enough to breathe. If the cabin had sealed itself, that meant no ventilation. He had the air in the tank, and his prisoner had whatever was in the room. Bull was sorely tempted to force open the door and go back out, but there was no way to know what he'd find, and doing so might condemn the woman on the bunk to death. That was always an option, but for now he needed information. The crewwoman's standard coverall name tag read Wang, though she looked more Caucasian than Chinese. An unusual case, or an alien mistake? Bull could imagine a cursory meme study showing Wang to be the most common human surname on Earth, but mismatching ethnicities when they rewrote the woman's memories. Bull searched the bunk storage drawers until he found a water bottle. After making sure it did actually contain water, he squirted a stream into Wang's face. The woman came to, lifting her head to stare fixedly at Bull.
"Why am I restrained?" she asked.
Bull gazed back without speaking. He found the woman's reaction interesting. He would have expected sputtering, cursing, protests, maybe spacer's jargon. Instead, this clinical attitude. He sat on the bunk opposite her.
"Have you captured me?"
Slowly, Bull nodded. The woman laid her head down and stared upward at the bottom of the bunk above her.
"I failed."
"Guess so."
Bull sat back. So, Wang seemed to know she was an enemy.
"What exactly was your mission?"
"I don't know."
"You tried to kill people. You may have succeeded. You were shooting up the passageways."
"I..."
Bull waited for long seconds. When it became apparent his captive wasn't going to answer further, he said,
"Who are you?"
"Security Technician Third Class Jennifer Wang."
"When did you come aboard ship?"
16 days ago at Triton."
"Before that?"
"I may not say."
"You may not? You mean you're not allowed to?"
"Correct."
"By who?"
"By whom? Objective case, English language."
A chill went through Bull. He leaned forward and gripped his weapon tighter. The fresh face of youth, the odd mixture of knowledge and social naivete.
"You're a pureling."
The woman turned her head away.
"I don't know that word."
Bull forced himself to relax and chuckled grimly.
"That damn near proves it. Every real human knows that word. It means you're a vat-grown clone, programmed with fake memories and infiltrated into Earthfleet."
"That would seem to make sense."
"And now you're my prisoner. I should kill you."
"I would prefer not to die."
Bull sat back.
"Interesting. Why haven't you killed yourself?"
"Because I would prefer not to die."
"Yeah, you said that. What I mean is, why are you being allowed to refuse? Purelings are compelled to kill themselves when captured, usually by using programmed biofeedback techniques to stop their hearts."
"I know nothing of that."
"What do you know?"
Wang wormed her right hand out through the netting, enough to free it from fingertips to elbow. She turned its palm to Bull.
"I know I got this scar when a dog bit me as a child."
"As a child? Where and when?"
"I don't know."
Bull leaned forward.
"And I don't see a scar, do you?"
The woman turned her head.
"No, but I feel it. I don't understand."
"The Eden Plague would heal all your scars, especially if it were years ago."
"It is strange."
"You're a pureling. It must be a random scrap of memory, something cut and pasted from the mind of a real human."
"I am a real human."
"I beg to differ, Pinocchio."
Bull sighed and tried his comms again. He hefted the pulse gun.
"I should kill you."
"I prefer—"
"Yeah, I get it. That's the only reason you're not dead."
"You respect my preferences."
"I don't murder prisoners of war."
"Why not?"
"My own moral code. It's not about you."
"Then I am human. You would murder an alien."
I wouldn't murder anyone. I would kill you if I had to, but you're sentient.
Bull remembered a blend, an insectoid called Madar who had died trying to defect to Earthfleet.
It is immoral to kill sentients.
It's immoral to murder them.
What is the difference?
Bull rubbed his neck and grimaced. He'd pulled a muscle, and sitting here didn't help.
Self-defense. If you try to kill me, I'm free to kill you.
Then you may kill me now, though I do not prefer it. I tried to kill you.
Yeah, no, you don't understand. Now that you're helpless, I won't kill you. It would be murder.
So, murder is killing the helpless?
Yes.
What is the opposite of murder?
Saving, I guess. Rescuing, giving your life so others can live, that's real humanity.
Dying in place of another person is human.
Bull nodded.
I'd say that's the ultimate expression of humanity.
But that means killing makes one inhuman. Yet humans kill each other. This makes no sense.
Benzana, you're like a child. Look, it's not always black and white, and I'm not the right guy to explain it.
Bull sighed, running his eyes over her face. So young, so sweet.
But she'd been shooting people. At people, anyway. You say you want to live. You say you're human. Humans shouldn't murder other humans.
Humans have routinely murdered other humans for many millennia.
Well, mostly we quit that when you aliens showed up.
I am not alien.
Well, you're not a woman.
I am a human woman. I've seen you around the ship. I have feelings for you.
For me? Bull laughed. You don't know me.
The feelings are real.
Bull thought about his first crush at the age of 12 and the overwhelming ache of it. If Jennifer Wang were a pureling, only recently decanted from a meme cloning pod and programmed to mimic humanity, she'd never have experienced such intense emotions until her adult hormones recognized a suitable male. Very flattering. But that only proves you're a sexual animal. It doesn't mean you're human.
I want to be human. I could not abort my compulsion to attack the crew, but I resisted. I fired, but I hit no one. Do you really think I could not have killed crewman Calvin?
Maybe not. So you claim you tried not to kill them?
It did not seem right. As you say, I did not wish to murder, so I am human. I am.
Bull shook his head ruefully.
Maybe you are. Mankind is born to trouble.
Wang's lips curled up in a wistful smile.
As the sparks fly upward.
Bull's eyes narrowed.
Where did you hear that saying?
I do not know. Perhaps it is another piece of implanted memory. What does it mean?
It means just as surely as the sparks rise from a fire, people will cause themselves problems.
Not if they submit themselves to the meme.
Bull snorted, half a laugh. You think the meme have no problems?
Only from those who resist.
And resistance is futile, huh? Screw that.
I do not understand.
I'd rather have human problems than alien solutions.
Jennifer chewed on that one for a while.
So, the saying counsels acceptance of trouble.
That's one way to understand it.
The saying is from Proverbs, a book of my people, written by King Solomon, said to be the wisest man who ever lived. Her forehead furrowed in thought.
So it must have a deeper meaning.
I was taught it's a caution against believing you can completely control a situation, and against the illusion of perfectibility.
The meme seek perfection?
The meme seek dominance, control, and stability, not the same thing at all.
Wang folded her free hand into her trapped one.
So, to have problems is to be human?
Yeah.
That proves it, then. I must be human.
Jennifer smiled and glanced down at her bindings.
I seem to have problems.
Bull felt a laugh bubble up in his throat.
You sure do, Miss Wang.
He sobered.
We both do. We're stuck in a room with limited air and I can't get a hold of anyone.
Bull tried his comms again to no avail.
If I force the door open, you'll die. I have only about 80 minutes of air left myself. I could start banging on the walls with metal, but I have no idea if that would attract friendlies or enemies. Protocol in this situation is to stand by and let search and rescue find us.
Then our way ahead seems clear. We wait.
For now. At some point, Bull would have to force open the door and try to find more air tanks, but he wasn't yet at that desperate point. Doing so would kill Wang. For long minutes, he tried to think his way through the problem, tried to come up with a way to keep Jennifer alive while he sailed forth. He began methodically going through all the storage compartments in the room, hoping for inspiration. Most of what he found consisted of the personal possessions of the crew who bunked there. They'd taken their suits and breathing rigs when the alarm had sounded. He'd hoped to be able to MacGyver some clever solution out of available parts, but there simply wasn't anything of use for breathing. Jennifer Wang watched him as he searched, but said nothing. After he sat and thought some more, one option occurred to him. If he kept the nearly empty first tank on his breathing rig, now down to about 10 minutes, and detached the second, full tank, he could give it to Jennifer before forcing his way out. The Pureling could release the air after Bull left and sealed the door. It would be wasteful and inefficient, but it would give Bull about 10 minutes outside. 10 minutes to find more air. As he watched condensation running down the door and felt the cooling temperature in the room, he realized air wasn't their only problem. The damaged ship's heat was leaching away, and the longer he waited, the more he used up the air supply in the short tank. The rig was simple and didn't allow him to transfer air from one tank to another. It had 2 bottles to allow one to remain in place while the other was swapped out. Bull stood.
Okay, Miss Wang, you say you don't want to die?
That is correct.
Have you given up on trying to kill people?
I will not murder anyone. I am human.
Good.
Bull released the netting and motioned Jennifer out of the bunk. She took his hand and held onto it as a child or a lover might, until he peeled it away, self-consciously. Any feelings she had for him, or he had for her if he didn't guard against them, were irrelevant right now. Even if her body was adult, her mind and emotions seemed those of a bare adolescent. He turned his body mostly away from the Pureling, but gripped his pulse rifle tight and kept his senses alert, watching over his shoulder for treachery.
One of those air bottles will show full. Take it off the rig. When I leave the room, I'll dog the door tight. Open the tank and you'll have air. I'll try to find more oxygen and contact rescue. You just sit tight.
I prefer to stand.
Well, then stand over there out of the way.
Bull pointed to the back wall.
Don't hold your breath. It will rush out when the pressure drops. Just remain calm and open your bottle when the door shuts. Ready?
Jennifer hefted the bottle, hand on the valve.
I am ready.
Here I go.
Bull rotated the dogging handle and set himself, pulling slowly but inexorably against the air pressure, exerting his entire cybernetic strength. There came a prolonged rushing sound, and he felt the air depart the room at the crack between the door and the jamb. As soon as possible, he opened the door and slipped through, pulling it shut behind him and dogging it. His smart suit constricted, and the clear, flexible plastic of his breathing rig inflated tight against the vacuum. Inside the room, Jennifer should be refilling the space with air, for perhaps an hour at most, probably less. Now it was up to him. Turning, he switched on his rig's headlamp and surveyed the cold wreckage around him. To the left, debris filled the passageway. To the right, it looked clearer, so he headed that direction. Bull picked his way carefully through, alert for attackers and also for sharp edges that might cut his suit. Light flickered ahead in the airless silence. He rounded a corner to see the backs of 2 suited crew firing weapons away from him. Another lay unmoving on the deck, sliced open by laser fire. Bull debated for just a moment. What if these were Purelings rather than real crew? How could he tell? This was always the problem with meme infiltration. The suits decided it. Jennifer Wang hadn't been in a pressure suit, probably because when her programming tripped, she was supposed to do as much damage as possible, as fast as possible, and then be killed. Putting on a suit would waste precious time, and suits were clumsy. But with the ship wrecked and the passageways in vacuum, who were the enemy the crew were fighting?
I have to play the odds, Bull told himself.
He moved forward to the corner and stood above the defenders, who crouched below. His height allowed him to take a half-covered position above them. He leaned out slightly for just long enough to let his optical implant grab an image of what was beyond, and then pulled back as he examined it. He saw a maintenance bot, really a telefactor, no doubt, controlled by a Purling tech nearby, wielding a heavy cutting laser. A moment later it flashed green, and one of the crew jerked back, his exposed arm holed. The laser would need a few seconds to recharge. Bull immediately leaned out with his pulse rifle. Cyber optics connected to his hardwired nerves allowed him near-perfect accuracy with his weapon, and he laid his aim point on the bot's communications node. A burst blew it apart, and the robot froze, now offline. Bull rushed forward and wrenched the laser off the thing's arm, detaching it from its power pack, just in case. He then returned to help the crew. The uninjured one, a woman, was treating the other crewman with the wounded arm. Bull tried his comm, but still couldn't raise anyone. He put his head against the uninjured woman's helmet to transmit his voice.
"What do you know?" he yelled. "Report!"
Her reply was tinny as she shouted back,
"Sir, we were winning until those hypers slammed into us, then all hell broke loose, and we ran into that bot, so I have no idea."
Bull clapped her shoulder.
"Let's get this man to the infirmary. You carry him, I'll lead."
The low gravity would make pulling the wounded man along easy. He didn't wait for her to reply, but made his way past the broken bot and down the passage. He came to a ladder leading upward toward the infirmary. He climbed it effortlessly. The hatch at the top was closed, of course, dogged automatically as separate sections were sealed against breaches. The mechanism would allow it to swing either way, in or out. Letting it swing out toward himself would make opening it easy, but closing it very difficult if the other side were under pressure, and vice versa. He decided to push it inward. Once he undogged it, he used the manual operation lever and his strength to force it away from him slightly. A hiss of air proved the other side to be pressurized. He slung his weapon and turned to wave at the crewwoman, signaling her to pass the injured man to him. With one hand grasping the injured man, he placed the other on the lever and gave it a powerful push. The door opened with a rush of air toward him, and Bull launched the man upward through it, then reached down to grab the woman. She was already moving. All he had to do was push her against the airflow and then follow her through. Once inside, he let the hatch slam shut and dogged it again. The barrel of a pulse rifle greeted him, held by a battle-suited Marine, and he spread his hands.
"Lieutenant Bentaros!"
he bellowed through the muffling layer of the breathing rig. The rifle was already dropping to show Gunnery Sergeant Kang's insignia and name behind it.
"Good to see you, sir,"
the NCO said through his open faceplate.
"We have most of the ship secure from the attackers, but she's in bad shape."
The crewwoman towed her comrade past the two Marines toward the infirmary. Bull let her go. She didn't need his assistance anymore, and he had his own job to do.
"Can I get to the armory? I feel naked without a battle suit."
Gunny Kang shook his head.
"Doubtful. Reaper and I and a handful of Marines barely got our suits on when the ship got hit. One of the other armories might be intact, but I doubt any suits will fit you, sir."
"Right."
Battle suits were customized to their wearers, but the spares could theoretically be operated by anyone. Anyone that could fit in them, that was. He wished he had the luxury of a spare in his size, but war material was always in short supply, even for frontline fleet Marines.
"You got comms? I can't seem to raise anyone."
Kang slapped his helmet.
"Yes, sir. Ultra-wideband is functional, but the HUD system's having trouble updating and passing data with all this damage. Reaper's got a scratch squad finishing off the last resistance."
"Captain Moorhead?"
"No contact, sir. Might be KIA.
"Bridge, Oxcon?"
"Oxcon is coordinating."
"Fleet sitrep?"
"Winning the engagement, though with severe casualties. Some kind of stealth ambush, but no details. My gut tells me if we get through the next hour, we'll be okay."
"The next hour?"
Bull checked his chrono. 20 minutes since he left Jennifer Wang stuck in the bunk room. The Purling should be all right, but it was remarkable that Bull hadn't run out of air yet. He was sure he'd only had about 10 minutes. He unsealed his clear, flexible helmet, taking a deep breath of ship's air. It smelled of metal and burnt plastic, but it refreshed him anyway. He then shrugged out of the harness that held the air supply on his back.
"I need a couple of full bottles. This one's got to be empty."
Bull trailed off in confusion as he looked at the air tank's gauge. 40 minutes of air remained. That was impossible, unless... He felt the color drain from his face and fear seize him.
Oh, shit! What's up?
Get a breathing rig or a spare suit and 2 extra bottles, now, and follow me!
Ben pulled the rig back on and sealed it. Kang scrambled to find the gear while Bull readied the hatch for opening. When Kang came back with a sack, Bull popped the seal and yanked the hatch open, waving for Kang to go through first. That allowed the armored marine to take point security and left Bull free to shut and dog the hatch. Then he took the sack from Kang. Using standard combat hand signals, Bull directed Kang toward the bunk room. They didn't encounter any resistance and soon reached the door. Bull opened the sack and took out a breathing rig, checking to make sure it could be activated with the flip of a switch. He then undogged the door, slamming his shoulder into it to pop it open, knowing as soon as he did, all the air in the room would vanish and he'd have to help get the rig onto Jennifer so she could breathe. The door flew open, and far less air than Bull hoped rushed out, as little air as he feared. Jennifer lay in one bunk, eyes closed and a faint smile on her face, the empty air bottle she'd taken from Bull's rig clutched to her chest. The bottle that should have contained an hour's air when she took it. But Bull's bottle still showed 40 minutes left, which meant that Jennifer had deliberately taken the near-empty one. And when she'd opened it after Bull left, she'd had no more than 10 minutes to breathe, if that. Why the hell had she done it? Jennifer wasn't breathing, and her face was pale and bluish. Bull fitted the rig onto the woman, activated it, and began an awkward CPR sequence.
Give her a battle stim,
Bull barked, forgetting that no sound carried in vacuum. He showed Kang the hand signal for medical assistance and mimed injection with one hand, the other continuing the chest compressions. Kang popped open his drug module and injected the motionless woman with a battle stim, and then shut the door and cracked the valve on an air tank. Air flooded the room and Bull's ears popped, and for another 10 minutes he worked on Jennifer.
Come on! Come on!
He recited over and over. But it was clearly too late. There was no sign of life. Even the Eden plague couldn't overcome total lack of oxygen and cell death. Bull sat back and wept, gasping. Kang turned away. Bull shook his head awkwardly to clear his eyes, and then peeled open his helmet to wipe them with the back of his hand.
Damn it, why did she do it?
Kang's harsh voice was uncharacteristically gentle.
Do what, sir?
Bull waved vaguely as if at flies.
Against my orders, she took the empty bottle. She left me with all the air.
Kang sketched a salute.
Then she was a hero, sir. She sacrificed her life for you. She was Earth Fleet.
She wasn't Earth Fleet, sir.
She was a Pureling. Bull reached over to close her eyes. Kang didn't reply for a long moment.
I don't understand.
Bull picked up Jennifer's air bottle and turned it until he could see something written on it in large block letters. She must have found a marker.
I don't understand either. But she did. Better than most, I think.
He handed the bottle to Kang, who read the words aloud.
I am human.
Peace Force, by Anne Christie. 1. How long? The old woman says when she finally lifts into consciousness. A long time. Take it slow. The old woman looks up at the person and sees a caring face. She's too blurry to make out details, but the old woman's vision will clear. It always does. How long? She repeats, her voice a creaking rasp. 230 years, Director Swanson, the sweet-faced younger woman answers. Her arm tingles when she lifts it to her forehead. Soon the tingles will become pain, but that too will pass. So long. Let me help you, the younger woman says, slipping an arm around the director to take her weight. The helper is stronger than she looks. There's not a hint of effort as she lifts her charge into a sitting position. Director Swanson tries to look around the room as she rises free from the cryo couch's sides. but the blur prevents her seeing more than a room with too much white in it. A hospital room? It's certainly not the room she went to sleep in. A lumpy bit of gray moves along a distant wall.
"Who are you?"
she asks the human-shaped lump.
"Director Swanson, I'm Facilitator Gray."
The director chuckles at the appropriate name. A gray suave is someone named Gray. How funny.
"Come closer so I can see you.
And don't call me that or else I'll feel old. Just call me Swanson. I like that better."
The form approaches, resolving into another woman, the one of such angular slenderness that she barely registers as that gender.
"As you wish," Gray says, inclining her head.
The pain begins, and Swanson tries to hide a grimace. It's always like this. Numbness replaced by tingling replaced by a searing pain. It shoots down each limb like lightning. But after the pain passes, she will feel herself again, so it's not worth acknowledging. Everyone must deal with pain sometimes.
"Healer 4 Alpha, is there something wrong with her?"
Gray asks. Swanson eyes the facilitator. Gray's voice is strangely without compassion or emotion, as if Swanson were a machine with a glitch, rather than a human waking from a too long cryosleep. And that name? Who calls another person 4 Alpha? More changes? The healer leans down to look at Swanson's face. Unlike Gray, her expression is exactly what one would expect from a good nurse. She smiles and attaches a small patch to the back of Swanson's thin-skinned hand, then looks at a display next to the cryo couch.
"No, Facilitator Gray, this is entirely normal for such a waking. She's in pain, but it will pass.
She's awakened 17 times before, however, and each will be more difficult than the last." The facilitator nods, satisfied, then stands still to wait. Swanson has been asleep a long time, but all this is very strange and not what she expected. The facilitator class was designed to be efficient and less emotionally driven, but this one seems almost too cool.
"What's wrong with you? You're a very odd duck," she says.
A flash of confusion crosses the angular face, which is actually a relief. At least Swanson can be sure Gray is human. Well, she can be almost sure. That certainty evaporates when the facilitator answers her.
"I'm not a duck. I'm a facilitator."
With a snort, Swanson holds out her hand for the healer.
"Help me up. I need to stab that thing to be sure it bleeds. Got anything sharp?"
Even Gray looks alarmed at those words. The healer merely pushes the medical cart a little further away from Swanson with her foot. It's done very discreetly, but Swanson laughs anyway.
"Why would you want to make sure I bleed?"
Gray asks.
"Because I want to deal with a human and you're like a ghoul, maybe a robot or something."
"I'm human, I assure you. There's no need to stab me."
The delivery is so deadpan that Swanson can only shake her head.
"Whatever."
Now that she's standing, she finally notices that hers is the only cryo couch in the room.
"Where are the others?" she asks.
The healer still grips her hand and places her other hand securely on Swanson's back to help her take her first steps in over 2 centuries. Swanson watches the healer carefully as she answers.
"Gone. The humanity directors made their final decisions. Of your group, the Peace Force directors, you are the last. Director Glenn went into the virtual world and Director Taylor died during his last revival."
This is surprising news and also sobering. Swanson realizes she is now alone, the sole decision-maker left in the entire human race. Her body seems to come alive with adrenaline. She hadn't expected to be the last. Surely out of the 8 director types, the humanity directors would have been last. Shouldn't they be tweaking these final humans until the last moment? Glancing at Gray, Swanson can't help but wonder if the humanity directors hadn't tweaked too much. Gray is still watching her with complete calm, an unsettling lack of interest in her halting steps or the old body in front of her. Swanson asks,
Why did you let Glenn go into the virtual?
I did not, Gray says without missing a beat. That was my predecessor. The reason was logical, however. Director Glenn would not have survived another cryosleep.
Quite suddenly, everything comes together. Swanson's DNA imprint was chosen for this job because she would be smart and quick. And she was, usually seeing all the angles before anyone else at the table. This moment was no exception.
Ah, I see, she says,
then glances at the healer still preventing her from keeling over on wasted limbs. No matter how brilliant the cryosleep technology, there was always some residual effect and the length of sleep she'd just endured had never been intended.
The healer lacks subtlety, but at least she seems to care, thought Swanson.
Facilitator, this is not seemly.
Gray answers in that same deadpan manner.
The truth is always correct.
With a roll of her eyes, Swanson eases her hand from the healer's and faces Gray, standing as straight as she's able to.
Well, you're at least true to your design. Let me be sure I understand. You waited so long to wake me because you believe I will not be able to sleep again, is this correct?
Yes.
And that means you need a decision-maker. A final decision, correct?
Yes, Swanson. This is correct. Or we will need your authorization to create another director if a decision is not yet deemed wise.
A ghost of a smile touches Swanson's lips. All these centuries, and now it's time. Finally.
That means we're finally done. At last. Let's make some decisions then, shall we?
2. Swanson feels good, or at least as good as someone of her normal biological age should feel. The effects of her long cryosleep have either worn off or been pushed away by good medicine and excellent care. The healers are marvelous. She sips a cup of hot tea as she reads yet another of the reports that have piled up during her latest long absence. The room around her feels empty, and it's distracting. The director's conference hall was meant to hold all the directors from all 8 lines while they worked. Each line was tasked with decisions in one area. The humanity directors worked on putting the last biological humans into the virtual worlds, then with tweaking the facilitators and healers, well, their loaded strands, so they would have humans perfectly suited to tending the virtual worlds. The nature directors repaired the planet and repopulated it with animals, either recreated from historical samples or bred from existing members. The infrastructure directors, the space directors, and all the rest had their tasks. So many generations of them had been born, learned their trade, then faded for the next in their line. Only when their final decision was made and their tasks confirmed complete could they join the other directors in the virtual and have no more directors in that line decanted to continue the work. It was strange to be the last. Swanson had never expected it, so she hadn't prepared herself for this feeling. Shaking her head to get rid of the strange sense of isolation, she returns to the report in front of her. It's yet another of the bad ones. Making a face at the horrific details collected from the quantum buoys, she sips again, but this time there is a bitter aftertaste. It isn't from the tea, really, but rather from the evil transmitted back to Earth with such ease. The ones who created the seed ships had much to answer for, and they would have answered had they still been alive. Perhaps it's good that the virtual worlds came into being long after those responsible for the atrocities born from those first colony ships had passed into history. Her eyes flick to the side. Facilitator Gray is sitting with unnatural stillness at the table to her left. At least Gray's no longer staring at her. With a snort of disgust, Swanson lowers the tablet and says,
"You really will sit there all day, won't you?"
Gray meets her gaze with perfect equanimity.
"Of course, it's my duty."
The label on the report Swanson's just read tells her it's number 13 out of 64. She narrows her eyes at the tablet, then asks,
"And all of those reports are bad? All aberrant?"
tilting her head the tiniest bit, Gray says, "Most of them. But we don't receive all reports anymore. Decay or breakage has cut some of the buoy communications."
Her teacup rattles a little in the saucer as Swanson sets it down. The shakes are still there.
"But this last one here was a report from a planet in progress. They hadn't even gotten the world habitable yet. They have some sort of slave situation, yet they've barely begun their work. How could things go so wrong so quickly?"
Gray's shrug is awkward, as if she were unaccustomed to such gestures.
"We're not sure, and there's no way to find out. The seed ships were entirely divorced from our data streams prior to launch to protect their integrity. Nothing of their design or specific protocols was left on Earth to prevent us from interfering in the future. Unfortunately, that also means we can't correct our errors. There is..."
Swanson waits for Gray to continue, but she doesn't, merely looking uncomfortable in her seat.
"Well, what is it?"
"It is possible that one line of the ships has been corrupted from the beginning."
"One line? Explain."
When Gray begins to speak again, Swanson can see that stating facts eases Gray, makes her more comfortable. It's hard not to wonder if perhaps they hadn't gone too far in designing the facilitator class. Perhaps they should have left more people skills in place.
"Director, as you know, there were two seed ships initially. Each would go to a different planet already determined to be a good candidate, confirm that data, and then replicate themselves using locally sourced materials. Then they launched their replicated ship toward the next candidate, which was determined during the replication phase, and only then begin the terraforming process. All the while, they expanded themselves into their final state, complete with all the facilities required for the long terraforming process. Only when all that initial work was done did they decant the first wave of loaded strands, the scientists and engineers, to confirm and guide the work planet side. You know all this?" Waving her hand for Gray to get to the point, she answers,
"Yes, of course."
"Well, the number designation for each ship is coded so no one on Earth would ever know exactly where the ships are located or which ship line they were created from. Again, it was done to prevent interference by Earth at some future date. The numbering system almost seems random."
Understanding now where Gray is heading, Swanson says,
"But it's not truly random."
A hint of a smile lifts Gray's angular features.
"No, we deciphered the code. In most cases, the corruptions appear to be from the line of the first seed ship. There are two, both probably caused by planetary disasters after colonization, that we link to the second ship, but none during development. The slavery issue you just read about takes place on approximately half the ships in the first seed line. This cannot be coincidence. It is likely a shared flaw in the code across that first line of ships."
Swanson takes up her teacup again and sips, considering all the ramifications.
"Well, that does make the initial tracking easier in some ways. If our peace forces can catch up to the ships of the second line, then they can wipe out the problem once and for all."
Gray gives another of those non-committal nods.
"What?"
"We believe that the original plan may be somewhat short-sighted."
Again, the teacup clatters into the dish. But this time, it is the pricking of her pride that shakes her fingers.
"How so? You do realize we've been planning this since before I was even born, before my mentor or even his mentor was born. Thousands of years of cryo-sleeping directors have planned this down to the nanite."
"Director."
At her glare, Gray corrects herself.
"Swanson, I don't mean to counter any plans, because the plans are perfection. It is only the additional information that calls for some alterations. I did note the two aberrant systems. In each case, their social constructs changed in unacceptable ways after planetary disaster. Please observe."
With that, Gray waves and a display lights up centered over the big table. "This is what we were able to reconstruct from the data we received from the quantum buoys. The stream was somewhat corrupted."
On the display, a small girl, no more than a handful of years old, is strapped to a T-brace, every part of her that can move secured by wide, dark straps. The brace is tilted a little, and without any preamble, a man wearing a hood and little more than a loincloth steps up and swings an axe. First one arm and then the other are severed under the power of two quick blows. Very quickly, another man comes forward and slaps handfuls of black goo onto the girl's bleeding stumps, then sets them alight with a torch. While Swanson's hand comes up to cover her mouth at the horror, the girl barely moves. When she is lifted from the brace and turned around, Swanson sees that her mouth is gagged and her eyes closed, but the little girl's chest hitches with uneven breaths.
"Turn it off! Turn it off! How dare you show me this monstrosity!"
The display disappears with another wave of Gray's hand, but she seems entirely unaffected by the horrors they have both just witnessed. Wisely, the facilitator says nothing and waits for the older woman. Regaining her composure by reminding herself that this happened long ago and far away, Swanson swallows down the bile that has risen in her throat.
"And the other? I don't wish to see it. Only tell me."
It is the opposite of this, but equally brutal. All save 3% of males are killed at birth. The rest are kept for breeding. This is terrible. Too terrible. Swanson slides an elbow onto the table so that she can rest her forehead in her hand. Her head has suddenly become so very heavy. She understands what Gray is saying even without saying it. Still, she must have it confirmed.
"And you're sure these atrocities happened after planetary disasters?"
"That is correct. In both instances. The one from the video is from a planet that had the terraforming process well underway and nearly 5,000 strands on the planet. No loaded strands, of course, since they maintain memories of their original life on Earth. Only strands that started as infants without memories can become colonists. Previous reports indicated all was well, and breeding was proceeding on the surface. An asteroid impact soured their land, and within a few years, the beginnings of this system were evident. That girl was to be a voice, a female who can speak. Most females are hands, which means they work, but have their vocal cords removed." Anger courses through Swanson's stiffening limbs. It is this kind of brutality on Earth that made humans create the seed ships in the first place. The ships were meant to give them a chance to develop without strife or war, without struggle, on new worlds untainted by humanity's savage history. They were meant to make us better, to help us evolve as a species. That has clearly not happened.
"Well, then, I know the first place the Peace Force should go," she says through gritted teeth.
Gray sighs a little, a strangely human gesture from someone almost entirely divorced from emotion. "While we have made strides in understanding the numbering of the seed ships, we will not experience those same successes with the planets. Their numbering is truly random. Only the seed ships know those locations, so they know which planets have already been taken. We do not, and will never know, where that planet is." Squeezing her eyes shut at the memory of that footage, Swanson says,
"But the advances in sensors on the new ships..."
"Yes,